not shooting at the thermonuclear weapons.
Catapults of propaganda.
Alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, and welcome to our bunker for the second time this evening. You don't know this, but we already recorded this entire show. I think somehow we've gone back in time.
We've looped ourselves, we're repeating June 13th, 2006 for the second time tonight.
Over and over again, it's Groundhog Day. Now, the reason we're having to do this is because we recorded the entire show earlier, and about 8 minutes in, I stood up because the ceiling fan above us was on, and when we previously left that on, we get a whirring sound in the background.
Yes.
Which is distracting, and Derek has to work very, very hard to get it out of there, and of course, it can't be completely removed. I hadn't realized when I did that, I had actually messed things up somehow.
Yeah, for some reason, well, I guess when she stood up, it basically triggered a switch that cut the microphones, and we didn't notice it until it was too late. The little recording device was still going along, but we just didn't notice there were no squiggly lines, which is the technical term for, sound recording.
Squiggus Linus, I think. No, we thought we were all done, and Derek was actually doing the mixdown, and he said, oh, no, the show disappears at 8 minutes in. Where on earth did... Now, mind you, we have had so many things go wrong. You just don't know because we don't talk about it very often because we've had so many glitches that have happened. It sometimes feels like it's cursed, especially with certain guests. And bless her heart, Janet Phelan, who is a wonderful woman, it almost feels like, okay, somebody doesn't want her information out there because when we interview her, our phones go out. All sorts of technical things happen. Huge storms, cats and dogs.
Yeah, it's biblical proportions. So anyway, it is fitting that this is taking place tonight as Janet Phelan will kick off our summertime conspiracy series. We'll have her in just a few minutes to begin the first of three parts of her interview, and she'll talk about some things that have taken place inside her family, some experiences that are somewhat painful and very distressing, really, when you hear them. Alarming, too, in that these are the sorts of things that could happen to any one of us, really.
That's right.
So some ugly entanglements with the law, which no one should... Well, we edited out the better part of that... interlude there, but the phone call that came in was from an AWACS plane that's circling overhead. They said
they call
were
themselves
from...
the Dish Network, but we know better.
Now, they know that we've got too many trees in this neighborhood to actually use a satellite television service.
Hey, speaking of AWACS planes.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that.
There's so much going on. And today, of course, you didn't mention is the 13th, which is probably part of the problem.
Exactly.
Not to mention the fact that I made our iced tea earlier with 13 tea bags.
So we've got plenty going on here, and of course, if you know us, we don't subscribe to the idea of actual curses.
No, we're not superstitious. We're really not.
Now, we do know that there are those.
We bring these things up because the occult.
Right, and we do know that there are people out there who believe and will actually practice the occult in such a way as to cast curses. And we talked with Russ Dizdar in the past about that, but we don't subscribe to the idea that you can't walk underneath a ladder and black cats crossing your path. That's a bunch of hoo-ha.
Oh, no.
So anyway, just in case you were getting the wrong idea there. Let's jump in. You mentioned the AWACS plane. Why don't we start there this time?
This is where we started last time. Oh, no, seriously, the AWACS plane, because we did bring it up. I think that's really important.
And that is
totally going underreported.
It really is. This is a story that was published in the Times of London, which reports an incident from China that isn't getting a lot of attention, but we think it's significant for a couple of reasons. First of all, it records a plane crash that took place in China about 125 miles southwest of Shanghai, a very high-tech airplane, a four-engine Russian-built cargo plane that was stuffed full of radar equipment that the Chinese apparently back-engineered from some time they spent in Israel back in the late 1990s. Mm-hmm. They want an AWACS plane that can compete with the AWACS aircraft of the United States military.
Now, the AWACS planes are the screw-top planes that communicate with the Aegis ships. They communicate mm-hmm. with the other planes. So they're the eyes of what's going on in the battle.
Yes.
Eyes and ears.
Right, yeah. High-tech computers, high-tech radars, and other sensing equipment. And they coordinate the attack on the battlefield mm-hmm. for the other aircraft that are taking place. Very important because especially with the United States military, you may have several different branches of the service involved in attack. You may have Army helicopters. You may have Marine Corps F-18s, Navy A-10s, mm-hmm. and then ships offshore firing cruise missiles in. So very important devices, very important planes and parts of the battlefield command and control structure. The Chinese don't have anything that can match it. And they want Taiwan back. Make no mistake. They want Taiwan. And having an AWACS, that AWACS capability to coordinate the battlefield would put them on a more equal footing with the United States military.
With the United States. And there's a good reason for that, because the United States has promised Taiwan. George Bush has said mm-hmm. to Taiwan, if China comes and messes you, look, if they become the bully on the playground, mm-hmm. just call in Big Brother George.
Yep.
And he'll come and rescue you. And in fact, we have ships that are stationed off Taiwan.
That is correct.
That keep track of everything. That's why we know this happened.
Yeah. Well, the report came from newspapers in Hong Kong, the initial reports on Monday. This crash took place.
But our ships actually tracked it going down.
Yes, that's correct. The crash took place a week ago Sunday, which would be June the 4th.
Yes.
So this plane, which was codenamed KJ-2000, was stuffed full of electronic equipment. Now, back in the late 90s, 1998, 1999, the Chinese thought they had a deal with Israel to load up this Russian-built cargo jet with the electronics that they wanted to outfit this plane. President Clinton's administration put pressure on the administration of Ehud Barak in Israel, mm-hmm. who canceled the deal. In fact, he let the president know during a meeting at Camp David that he had canceled the deal and sent a note of regret to the premier of China. Well, the Chinese technicians had been taking notes during their time in Israel, and apparently they felt that they had learned enough that they were able to reconstruct what the Israelis were going to install on this plane.
I guess they didn't learn enough.
It is possible, and it is speculated, that intelligence operatives, whether from Israel or the United States or other nations, might have fed some bad information or some bad electronics to the Chinese, which resulted in the crash of this plane. And not only the crash of this plane, but the deaths of 35 of China's top electronic weapons specialists.
I think that is a huge blow to any program they have to come up with this plane. Mm-hmm. Because these, you know, they've been working on this for some time.
Yep. Well, clearly. I mean, since 1999. So,
well, yeah,
they've been
not
going
only
on this
that,
for-
but I mean, you... Frankly, it's just a loss of life, which is really tragic
it
as
is.
Well. And our hearts go out to their families. And you know, this reminds me of the case back in the late days of Bill Clinton when a plane was captured, shot down and captured by the Chinese and stripped.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was for the purpose of gaining knowledge and reverse engineering.
Right. Not only to determine what our capabilities were, but to take advantage of those capabilities and build them into their own weapons systems.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it just points up the intensity with which the Chinese and the United States are struggling over Taiwan.
Mm-hmm. And, I have to be honest. You know what I thought at the time?
Hmm.
I thought at the time, and you always have to wonder, maybe it's just my imagination, but was that a convenient way of giving information to the Chinese?
Bad information. Well, you know, it could well be. This could have been.
Or even good information because, you know, the Clinton administration was pretty cozy with the Chinese.
Well, it was, but I think the. Well, that's very interesting. We have to speculate about that.
Tinfoil hat.
Yeah, exactly.
We have no evidence for that. That's
simply my
writer's imagination speculating there.
That would be an interesting way, though, of slipping a Mickey, if you will, mm-hmm. into the other side, letting them think that they'd captured a plane and that our guys had tried to destroy the electronics on board and erase hard drives and shred documents.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, gosh, they didn't get it all. Oh, darn.
But
it turns out that, maybe the information had been deliberately lost, as mm-hmm. it were. Well, there's something that Well, this is another thing that's hidden in plain sight, but we need to talk about this. This is big. Jerome Corsi, who we talked about last night because of his article concerning the NAFTA superhighway running from Mexico to Winnipeg through Kansas City to kind of fast-track goods imported into the continent, basically, through ports in Mexico, bypassing the Longshoremen's Union, which, of course, cuts costs for the guys who are doing big business, and then running them up into the U.S. and Canada on Mexican trucks, which, again, are operated at a much lower cost than American trucks, not bound by the same safety restrictions necessarily. Jerome Corsi has a new article in Today, the 13th, the today's edition of WorldNet Daily, talking about how the Bush administration is sneaking behind Congress's back, more or less, to create a North American superstate. Now, last March, the president, along with the Prime Minister of Canada at the time, Paul Martin, and the president of Mexico, Vicente Fox, signed an agreement called the Security and Prosperity Partnership, or the SPP. This is an agreement that apparently is intended to develop coordination of government operations between the three nations. It's to take NAFTA. Yeah, sort of a trilateral agreement, actually. It is to sort of create a super NAFTA, you know, give NAFTA real teeth. There is a group working inside the Department of Commerce now, which was set up by the president, or at the president's direction, which is operating without the oversight or consent of Congress. Now, if you remember your Constitution classes, the president cannot enter into foreign agreements without the advice and consent of the United States Senate. In other words, they have to approve any treaty with a foreign government. Apparently, what Mr. Corsi has learned by reading through these documents, which are available on the internet, that the government is working to implement this knitting together of Canada, the United States, and Mexico without the oversight or agreement of Congress. He's just bypassing Congress, which is not too surprising considering that with his signing statements on bills passed by Congress, he's been doing an end run around Congress ever since he took office.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, and as much as we may complain about the security of such a superhighway, we've talked about the fact that the ports aren't all that secure anyway.
No, that's true. What's really alarming is that when Corsi contacted the head of the SPP office inside the Department of Commerce, they work out of the NAFTA office for the Department of Commerce. A spokeswoman named Jerry Word was asked about why they're operating in secret, why they're not making a bigger deal of this. Like, hey, Americans, won't it be great when we become one great big super state with our Canadian and Mexican brothers? She said, we didn't want to get the contact people of the working groups distracted by calls from the public.
Yeah.
I mean, folks like us.
So we're a distraction?
Yeah, we might want to pick up the phone and say, hey, what are you doing?
We're paying your salaries.
Exactly. Well, apparently, that doesn't matter.
No.
They don't want them distracted by angry people calling up and saying, we object to giving away our sovereignty and creating a super state with these other nations. Now, we don't have any problem with Canada running Canada or Mexicans running Mexico. But this is not what we signed up for here for the United States. We did not sign up to become part of a supranational organization.
No, and it really does feel, well, in fact, we know. We can tell from the legislation that is happening that that's the direction it's going in. You know, I'm surprised that PETA hasn't jumped on this. I mean, think about it. The armadillo factor, the impact on the armadillo
highway
population.
On the you know, I hadn't even thought about that, but you're right. We took a drive down to Springfield, Missouri last spring. And we weren't aware of how many armadillos there are in Missouri.
Because now, up here, there are none.
Yeah, in St. Louis area. But when you get southwest of say, Rolla on I-44, there are quite a few.
You're down by Oklahoma down there. So
yeah, exactly. Springfield is down in the southwest corner of the state, closer to Tulsa than St. Louis.
One per mile. And we're not talking live armadillos.
No.
Those of you who live in the south and southwest, you know what we're talking about.
Yeah, armadillos don't fare well when they tangle with vehicles moving at 60, 70 miles an hour.
And these trucks will be going very quickly, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. This super highway, if you haven't read the article linked to in yesterday's show notes on PID Radio, please do. This super highway that they're talking about will run from Mexico all the way up to Winnipeg. The first stop for customs for these trucks running up this super highway will be in Kansas City.
A Mexican.
Yeah.
Stop. That, in Kansas City.
This highway is going to be about a quarter of a mile wide.
Mm-hmm.
It is huge. And, of course, the armadillos, well, they're, frankly, stupid. And they're going to try to make it across the highway. The carnage.
Oh, the carnage.
When I was in high school.
Plus, aren't they so cute?
They are cute. But, you know, when I was in high school on the debate team, one of the disadvantages that was always raised to any plan proposed by an affirmative team. You know, the affirmative team would come up and say, we have a problem with X, and so we present this plan Y that will fix the problem. And I love being the second negative speaker, because that was my job to show exactly why the other team's plan was going to create worldwide chaos and destruction. And one of my favorites was always titled Hamburger on the Highway.
Oh.
You change this law by removing these safety restrictions, we're going to have hamburger on the... Well, anyway.
Hey, don't say that down
gruesome,
in my neck of the woods.
Kind of gruesome, but yeah, you'd think that somebody
Roadkill
at PETA...
Roadkill Cafe, that's where we ate.
Somebody at PETA should have thought of this. Well, as you probably know, our president... stiffed his breakfast guests at Camp David this morning.
You guys pick up the check. I'm flying to Baghdad.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He flew to Baghdad for a meeting with Prime Minister al-Maliki, who has a rather interesting solution to the problems they've had with security there recently.
Well, you know, it was not only to go and affirm that he recognizes al-Maliki's authority. I think it was partly gloating the fact that we've killed, what's his name? Al-Zarqawi,
yeah,
supposedly, and assuming he wasn't dead a long time ago. Look, we killed him again,
mm-hmm.
And again. Find al-Zarqawi in this picture.
Look, he's right next to Waldo.
He's not even trying. Anyway, he went over there also because al-Maliki has just initiated, and mm-hmm. I think it just started because it was to begin the next day. And over there, it's probably the next day now.
Yeah, they're about 8 hours ahead.
Yeah, Operation Lightning, I think, is something like that. Is it? Do you have the name in front of you?
I do.
Anyway,
not,
it's essentially deploying 75,000 Iraqi and multinational troops in Baghdad.
Yeah.
Not in Iraq.
Just in Baghdad. Now, I'm not sure how many troops we have in Iraq right now. I'll need to look that up, but that would be
doesn't
quite...
that sound like a big number?
Quite a lot of soldiers.
I thought it was a typo when I saw it, and I looked around, and now it's 75,000.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting, though, the way it's put out in the press, Iraq and multinational forces, as
uh-huh.
though there are a lot of other nations participating in this coalition. Let us be blunt. The multinational forces are pretty much the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few other nations who have contributed their forces. And we don't demean the ability of these other nations
heavens
to fight.
No. It's simply they just don't have the numbers yet, is what I would assume. Now, if I'm totally wrong on this, please let us know. But I'm picturing post-war Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And as they were undergoing the reconstruction, for the prime minister of Germany at the time to say... we're going to deploy 75,000 German troops and some multinational troops
mm-hmm.
to do the following, to ferret out all of the resistance
mm-hmm.
in Berlin.
Yeah.
These are the troops that had just months before been fighting the multinational troops.
That is true. Yeah. I'm finding a couple of sources here, and I haven't nailed it down exactly, but right now we're somewhere around 150,000 American soldiers.
Boy, that's a lot.
In Iraq. And they want to take 75,000 soldiers and just pour all of them into mm-hmm. Baghdad mm-hmm. in order to make Baghdad safe.
Along with airstrikes, and I think part of the reason for that is because that was so successful.
Yeah. When I made the comment that I made about the multinational forces, my point was not to demean the other nations who've contributed troops. My point was simply this. We're not the United States in Iraq. There would be no other nations in Iraq at the moment.
No, I think that's probably true. In fact, many nations are pulling out. Blair had promised that he would pull out 8,000 troops Oh, gosh. I think they're starting to pull them out now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this this strategy, this move, works in order to in securing the capital there, because frankly, Baghdad is a very dangerous place. Even inside the green zone, it's not really all that safe. But certainly outside the green zone, it's really gotten ugly. We talked the other day about the number of dead and people who are abducted in Iraq, and it's the number is thousands this year alone.
It's horrendous.
So it may take something like this kind of a bold move in order to clean things out. But part of the problem is that many Iraqis believe that the problem is being caused by these security forces working for the Department of the Interior Ministry
Iraq. I don't think this is going to win a whole lot of friends.
No.
With the people whose houses are being, you know,
blown up.
You know what? Speaking of security, I think here in the United States, as we approach the 19th of June, we need to look to North Korea, because Kim Jong Il is bored, and he is, you know, we're not paying nearly enough attention to him. And, but there is a story coming out of Pravda that may have some legs, and by that I mean there may be some truth to it, and it may actually. It may actually be something we have to take a look at, because if you'll notice that there's a story that North Korea now has a missile that could reach the United States.
Yeah. It's called the Taipongdo 2, and Pravda reports that the test of this missile could be considered an intercontinental ballistic missile, because it can reach the U.S. Now, we found out over the weekend as we interviewed Jerry E. Smith for his book about HAARP in Alaska, that we have already in the recent past discovered the warhead from a North Korean missile in Alaska.
Right.
Now, the rest of the North American mainland, relatively speaking, isn't that much farther. So this missile supposedly has a range of about 6,000 kilometers, which roughly speaking is about 4,000 miles, give or take.
Now, what's the best way for the rocket to go? Would it be over the top, or would it be across the Pacific?
I don't know.
Because the range of this is 6,000 kilometers, so that's about 3,800 miles.
Roughly, yeah. I don't know. So that's a question that one of our military listeners might be able to give us some advice on.
Well, the reason we mentioned June 19th in conjunction with this story, and this is a story that if you look at it on Watcher Magazine, you'll see that I've posted a related article where the United States actually does seem to be worried about this possibility. They're hearing rumors, too, and by they, I mean intelligence. Next Monday, the 19th, is the day. It's bug out day. It's COG day. Continuity of Government Day, when 4,000 government employees are going underground.
Yeah, and it's interesting timing that this test being reported by Pravda is taking place at the same time. In addition, it's also interesting timing in that next week is the summer solstice, which is a date of some importance to those who are connected, who practice the occult arts. So we will see. This test was originally reported as being the largest continuity of government test ever in United States history. Turns out there was one test back in the 50s that actually employed about 6,000 government workers. But still, rounding up 4,000 government employees in Washington, D.C. and sending them off to underground bunkers is a pretty big test.
It's a big test. And it's just, you know, it could be that it's nothing. And again, we often bring up stories like this that might make you just feel a little bit worried, but Derek and I have said many, many times, we don't tell you these things to make you feel afraid, because we believe that Jesus Christ is in control, and therefore we are not afraid. We like to be informed.
Yep. As long as we're talking about weapons, let's bring up one here that we didn't talk about the first time we did this show, you know, back before we time looped into the past. There was a treaty that was signed in 1967 and approved by the United Nations, which banned weapons of mass destruction.
Oh, I'm glad you're bringing up this story, because I'm sorry we missed it before.
Yeah, good. This is an important story. The UN in 1967 approved a treaty that banned weapons of mass destruction from being deployed in outer space. Apparently, the United States is now asserting its right to develop weapons for use in outer space. because, well, gosh, we have those satellites up there, which are very important, and we need to protect those satellites against threats from outer space and perhaps inner space. And so anyway, the State Department has insisted that we have the right to deploy in space if we so choose.
But we don't have anything there yet. That's what they claim.
Right.
Well, we don't have anything up there yet, but we just want to be able to if we needed to.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Uh-huh.
That means they've got them.
Well, sure. Sure. I mean, publicly, I mean, there's always information that's released for public consumption and then information that's released back channel diplomatically to other governments on a, you know, need-to-know basis. And this is a way of sending a public signal, I'm sure, that is being interpreted the same way we're interpreting this by other governments.
Sure.
If we're claiming that we've got a right to do it, it's because we're already doing it or have plans to do it in the works. So we will see how that goes. And while we're talking about that, it also appears that we are ramping up our biological weapons facilities and cranking up production of biological weapons at Fort Detrick again. And this is something we've got a long history of, long tradition of here on this particular continent. Our British forefathers here used blankets poisoned with smallpox to decimate the Indian tribes and kind of soften them up for the attacks. But I think most Americans, I know I'm surprised whenever I read about how extensive our research is into these sorts of weapons, would be really disturbed to find out that the United States is pouring as much money as it is into developing anthrax, Ebola, and other weapons, other poisons and toxins to be
used
as weapons.
There's also a story, and one of our listeners sent this one in. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't tell you who it was. But you may be able to find out who. It's a story about how labs are competing for the right to build the better nuclear weapon.
Yeah. So, you know, it just makes you wonder, why are we entering this? Is it all about money, or is something coming that we feel we need to prepare for?
We signed a non-proliferation treaty.
Mm-hmm.
We're not supposed to be doing this. These are being marketed as essentially backups. This isn't proliferation. It's, these other, the shelf life on these others is coming up for their.
The use by date is coming up close on these weapons that we've already got in the silos. I do have it here.
Who sent that to us?
It was Ken.
Ken, thank you very much.
Yeah,
Ken.
Lawrence Livermore Laboratory and Los Alamos are competing to design the first new nuclear bomb to enter the United States arsenal in decades. Yeah, I guess they have a contest there, sort of like the tinfoil hat contest, except...
they won't have the cool prizes that we have.
No, that's true. That's true. They'll be jealous. But they will, you know, when they get to actually play with their toys, boy, will they be... It will be spectacular. Yeah, of course, we just gently remind you, our loyal listener, that Los Alamos turned up a whole bunch of plutonium... Well, it didn't turn it up. Actually, it's gone missing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a bookkeeping error.
Yeah.
So you're saying you're that poor at keeping track of your stuff?
Yeah, yeah. So
Well, we lost a bunch of laptops, too, but let's not go into that.
Right, exactly. And we blamed it on poor old Wen Ho Lee.
I know.
Yeah.
At least you got some money out of it.
Finally.
Hey, speaking of people who finally got the courts to give them good news. Carl Rove.
Yeah, yeah.
Got a get-out-of-jail-free pass today.
This is really interesting because there's been speculation. Reporters in Washington have been speculating that Rove was going to be indicted now for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I know.
There have been some meetings, quiet meetings, between Patrick Fitzgerald and Rove and his staff.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, who was it that we heard on an interview? And she essentially said when she was told that Patrick Fitzgerald was in charge of things, she thought, oh.
The
fix is in.
Yeah, Indira Singh.
Yes.
Indira Singh, who we would dearly love to have an opportunity to interview. But she said, I think she was interviewed by Michael Corbin on his excellent program, For a Closer
Look. She helped
us
with our wall of paranoia,
yes.
Although she isn't aware of it.
She said that Fitzgerald is somebody who has the public image of being a real bulldog and going after the wrongdoers, but can be trusted to go just so far and not any farther.
Mm-hmm.
And so the meetings with Rove were apparently to work something out. The interesting thing is, and don't want to go too far into this because we do need to get to our interview here fairly soon, but there's some speculation that the Jack Abramoff investigation has turned up information that is being used by the administration to coerce members of the Republican Party who are connected to Abramoff to go along with the plan, to play ball. Mm-hmm. And don't know that that's what happened here in the Rove situation, but just wanted to mention that because it is interesting that there are certain things that are getting through Congress over the objections of some Republicans mm-hmm. who don't like the way things are going.
Yeah.
But things are falling into place. One thing in particular, going back to Iraq for a moment, the appropriations bill, there was a supplemental appropriations bill to finance the war in Iraq that passed the Senate and the mm-hmm. House. Both bills had amendments attached to them that contained language that would have ruled out a permanent presence, a permanent military presence in mm-hmm. Iraq. After the joint session between the House and the Senate to work out the differences between their appropriations bills, that language was removed.
Well, you know, when you build a nice big super base and a big embassy, you hate to leave them behind.
Yeah, exactly. We got to have people there to, you know, somebody there to, you know, keep it, keep the lights on, I guess.
Yeah.
So
I've got stuff in the fridge.
That may be one example of how the this information, the Abramoff scandal, might be used in order to get things done.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of there, but sadly we are running out of time and we don't want to shortchange our guest. We have the first part of the interview with Janet Phelan up today. And you know what? Derek had, speaking of so many things that go wrong, that phone call that night, so many things happened. And it ended up that Derek did the call alone with
Janet
Phelan. But you know, it was just one of those things. But you know what? It's a real sobering look into what could happen to any of us.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a lovely woman to share some very personal thoughts and some very personal pain with you. So here's part one with Janet Phelan.
We're pleased to welcome back to our guest line, Janet Phelan, investigative reporter. Janet, welcome back to the electronic airwaves or cyber waves of PID radio.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, we're glad to hear you again. You know what? You've been traveling, and you've had a lot of things happen in your life. Is there anything about you, just the time between? It's been probably, what, a couple months between now and our last year? So is everything, have you learned anything more about the water situation or?
I'm working on other aspects of it now. And at this point, there's not a delineative report that I can release, but there is some chemical analysis in process. I have more strange interviews with DWP where they are lying, you know, through their teeth more and more, but I'm waiting for the chemical analysis to come through, and at this point in time, that hopefully will provide more illumination.
Okay. Well, we'll certainly look forward to finding out what the result of the chemical analysis is that will either confirm or perhaps send the investigation down a different track, if mm-hmm. nothing else. But one of the stories that you've been writing and posting about on the indie media site in Los Angeles is very distressing in that it deals with a topic that I think a lot of people would find disturbing if it were happening in their own family. And the details of this story, I think, are such that it's not impossible to imagine it happening to someone else. In other words, if it could happen to you, it could happen to someone else. Why don't you start at the beginning, Janet, and just kind of lay it out, what's been going on, the situation with your family, and then from there we'll go into the implications for how this might, why this might be important to everyone listening.
Right. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to discuss this because this was the event that was absolutely life-altering and put me, you know, from a kind of mainstream media, a stupid path, onto a more awake path. This has to do with what happened to my mother,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Emily Phelan, formerly of Temecula, California, spend an entire session on the radio on discussing the demise of a retired Jewish psychologist may seem a little unusual, but the untimely and unnatural death of my mother and the way that this happened has massive implications in terms of what is coming down in this country. And so I'm going to try to discuss the kind of the bare bones of the situation that happened. There is documentation for this fall, and I'm going to try to move through it rather quickly so that I can focus on the implications, because it is the implications of what happened to her, and as a result of my defending her life, what happened to me, that has relevance for those listening to this. Many of you, I believe, do know me as the water girl. I'm only talking about the planned use of water as a weapon. But most people aren't aware that my family was targeted. My family was on a death list, and back in 2000. So, first of all, I want to give a little overview about who my family is. My mother, Amelie, had been born in a Jewish family. She's Jewish. She had gone to school on the East Coast. She received her master's degree in English from Cornell and her PhD in psychology at Syracuse University. At Syracuse, she met and married Dr. Solomon Darin. He had come over from Russia. He was Jewish to escape the pogroms. They were killing Jewish people in Russia. And he had gotten a job as professor in the medical school at Syracuse University. He was several decades her senior. His wife had, he was widowed. And 7 years later, after they married, Solomon Darin died of a heart attack. And my mother moved to Alton, Illinois, to work in a state hospital there. She had her PhD at that point.
Right in our backyard here. Okay.
And in Alton, she met my father, who was my father, James Phelan, who at that point was a cub reporter at the Alton Evening Telegraph. They married. They had my sister in Alton. They moved to California, where they had me. And my father went on to quite a bit of prominence in his field. He worked as an investigative reporter for the old Saturday Evening Post between 66 and 69, and freelanced widely for publications like Forbes, Fortune, Playboy, Esquire, Los Angeles Times, and he also published 3 books. His first book made the cover of Time magazine. It came out, I believe, in 76 or 77. He covered very sensitive issues. He wrote rather extensively on J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. He had some pivotal work to do with the Kennedy assassination in terms of DA Jim Garrison's charges against Clay Shaw. Clay Shaw was the only man ever brought to trial for the Kennedy assassination that happened in New Orleans. My father also covered Howard Hughes. He followed Ronald Reagan on the campaign trail. His article on the Nixon-Hughes loan was credited by Governor Pat Brown with costing the gubernatorial election in California, costing it from Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon didn't make the grade. Pat Brown won the election, and Pat Brown felt that it was due to my father's article on the Nixon-Hughes loan.
So your father was sort of like the Michael Isikoff or Cy Hirsch of his generation.
Well, my father almost defied categorization. He was a maverick. He was a loner. He wasn't really invested too much in understanding conspiracy, but he saw a lot of corruption going on, and he was kind of a corruption buster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'd go in and expose this stuff, and it would be like all over, you know, the Esquire or Forbes or something, and then he'd move on to another story. And he in several cases, he kind of derailed some rather evil plans by some evil, powerful people. He considered himself a truth seeker, and he made many, many, many enemies. In fact, he had very few friends, and he was dedicated to his work. He loved his family dearly, and he was pretty relentless in his search to uncover truth. Now, he got his FBI file in the 80s, and under the Freedom of Information Act, and he became aware, big surprise, that there was a tap on his phone. And he began to go down to the corner to make his sensitive journalistic calls. The tap apparently had been on the phone for quite a while. As a teenager, I thought my father was probably a little paranoid about this. Unfortunately, it turns out he really wasn't paranoid enough. The tap was on the phone. My father passed away in 97 of lung cancer at the age of 85. And in late 2000, the federal government showed up in my inbox, so to speak, in the person of Special Agent Jack L. Smith. At that point, my family, particularly my mother and myself, were catapulted into extreme danger. Jack L. Smith, who resides still at the condo that we shared for a while in West Hollywood at 7911 and 1/8 Norton Avenue in West Hollywood, he made an outreach to me that was ostensibly a, you know, a romantic kind of outreach. And he had reached when I was 48 years old. I had been divorced for quite a while, and I had been in rather poor health. I was concerned, you know, that I was never going to get married again. And suddenly, up shows this guy, and he's attractive and smart. He's got all this political kind of insider information, and he is just pursuing me. And he presented himself really as the perfect mate for me. Like me, he loved theater. Like me, he came from a family that was mother Jewish, father not Jewish. You know, just like me, he was politically liberal. Well, it turned out that none of this was true. None of it. He lied about nearly everything. He lied in order to create a persona that I would invest in emotionally, which I did. I was very vulnerable, 48, divorced, health problems, you know, looking frantically for that final, you know, wonderful mate. And I fell in love with him, and very shortly after, some strange things started happening where I was living. I was living in Long Beach. He was living in West Hollywood. Suddenly, I'm getting all these phone calls from my landlady. I have to leave. I have to move out. She wouldn't give me a reason why. She was getting kind of, you know, insistent. And for a strange reason, I couldn't find another place to rent. I mean, I never had any problems like this before. I didn't get it, but hey, there was Jack, and I, you know, had to leave my place, so I did move in with Jack Smith. And in a sense, what Lauren Murray had said to me when I told her this story, she went, oh, they parked you with him. And yes, they did. They parked me with him. And what I was unaware of at that point in time is that Jack L. Smith, his cover job is at iMagic, which is a digital imaging company that's in Burbank. His actual job is as a federal Mata Hari. And apparently, I understand that other women have gotten involved with Jack Smith. I don't believe many of them are alive. One of the more important things that he lied to me about was his Jewish roots. The charade that he got involved in was quite complex. He introduced me to his supposedly aunt and uncle, Dr. Marge and Philip Oderberg. They live in the West Los Angeles area. They are both clinical psychologists who practice in the West Los Angeles area. And apparently the connection was that Jack Smith's mother was supposedly Marge Oderberg's sister. Jack's mother had conveniently expired. Apparently that is also not true. So the Oderbergs also participated in this charade. I had a Thanksgiving dinner at their house. Jack took me to a bar mitzvah, more of the Jewish stuff, at of the Oderbergs' grandson. I went to, you know, the temple, to the party afterwards. There may not even be a familial connection whatsoever. And this was a creation of a false reality was going on so that I would feel comfortable and emotionally invested, while Jack began to destroy my family, which is exactly what he did. At the very end of my association with Jack, his best friend told me that Jack was not Jewish. So that false reality was something that I did feel comfortable with until, of course, things began to fray and shred in my life. One thing I want to say briefly about my Jewish family is we weren't very Jewish. I never went to synagogue until I was in my 40s, and I went out of curiosity. We celebrated Christmas. We celebrated Easter. We were pretty much, you know, the garden variety, middle-class, secular family. But the people in power are really concerned with bloodlines. And as a bloodline, my mother is Jewish. I am Jewish because my mother is Jewish. And that was of more concern to them than them, and I use that word them so mm-hmm. often, than the real religiosity of my family. Now, at the time that I got involved with Jack Smith, my mother was up in her 80s. She had recently retired as a clinical psychologist, and there had begun to be some irregularities and some disappearances of money. My father had left an estate. There was a trust set up, and there was somewhere under $1 million, close to $1 million, but under $1 million in the trust. My mother had been the trustee, and money was just flying out of the accounts. And my sister Judith Phelan, who is now living in Oakland, had been living with my mother and my father when he was alive since 1990, and the feeling was that my sister was stealing from the estate. My mother and I certainly didn't want to get my sister in criminal trouble, and we began to like kind of worry about what to do, and Jack, of course, was also worried. How nice of him. The fact is, my sister had finagled a joint signing on my mother's bank accounts, and it turns out, and I do have documentation for this now, my sister was commandeering checks that my mother was writing and forging endorsements on these checks and depositing them into her own account. Many of these checks were made out to me. My mother and I had been very close. My sister was saying, hey, Janet needs $500. Janet needs $1,000. Well, I didn't and wasn't asking for it, but Judy would take these checks, forge my endorsement, and deposit them into her account. And I do have evidence of this. I have enough checks and enough records now to show that it was probably somewhere in the nature of $50,000 that was done this way. So in order to, there began to be some concern about, you know, monies, et cetera. I had been, had some health problems. I wasn't working. We were all kind of depending on this trust and this inheritance. And so Jack began to maneuver us towards a resolution of this financial problem. And what he did was to maneuver us towards a professional fiduciary / conservator named Melody Z. Scott. Melody Z. Scott has a business called Care Incorporated in Redlands, California. She was recently the subject of an expose on the front page of the Los Angeles Times just a few months ago, which essentially exposed her as a cunning and manipulative thief. She preys on elderly people and gets control of their lives and their finances. The elderly people often don't do very well under her care, and they certainly don't do very well financially, although Mrs. Scott does. Now, Mrs. Scott's attorney is J. David Horspool, who also does business in Redlands, California. Now, we were kind of maneuvered towards these people, and on December 2nd of 2001, my mother signed a conservatorship nomination, nominating Melody Z. Scott as her conservator of person and estate. Now, mm-hmm. at that point in time, according to records that have now surfaced, Jack L. Smith suddenly paid off half of what he owed on the condo at 7911 and 18 Norton Avenue. And given what he was making at his magic job, he would not have been able to suddenly put down over $50,000 the month after my mother signed the conservatorship nomination. Now, these are details, these are personal details, and later on in this broadcast, I will discuss the relevance of these particular details for others. Now, Melody Scott moves very quickly towards essentially destroying my mother's life. She placed aides in my mother's home, ostensibly to care for my mother, Emily, although none had been needed before. She began funneling thousands of dollars a month to my sister, Judith, who, in a moment of uncharacteristic honesty, called this hush money. Melody Scott also cut off my access to my trust fund. As I previously stated, I had suffered from some poor health and had relied on this money to survive, and it was suddenly not accessible for me. She also began to threaten to call the police when I went to visit my mother in a family home in Temecula. Now, this was all very distressing. I had been extremely close with my mother, and suddenly, you know, not only the financial arrangements, but the personal relationship with my mother was being interfered with by a stranger. And I, you know, began to try to maneuver legally around this with not much success. And I had become aware that my mother's health was careening downward under the care of Melody Scott and her aides. And in the middle of June of 2002, I received a desperate call from my mother. She was very ill and told me that no one was paying any attention to her. Now, I was quite alarmed, and I drove to Temecula from West Hollywood to find my mother too ill to even walk. I immediately took her to Rancho Springs Hospital emergency room. Her condition was assessed. She was trundled into surgery. She was apparently fibrillating, and a pacemaker was inserted to correct her failing heart. Incidentally, my sister Judith declined to ride to the hospital with us. She insisted that she had to go out and have her nails done. So I returned from the hospital to the family home, and I started to look at my mother's medication. My mother had been a heart patient for over a decade. She had been taking a heart medication called Cardura. And at that point in time, this was June, there were two full undispensed bottles of Cardura. One had been filled, I believe, in April. One had been filled in May. And they were sitting there. No one had given my mother, who was a heart patient in her 80s, her heart medicine for over 2 months. And goodness knows what else had happened to my mother under the care of these people. At that point, I called the police. They came, they counted the pills, and, you know, there's quite a hoopla. Melody Scott was calling and screaming that they needed to arrest me. I mean, it was all kinds of crazy stuff. A police report was filed. When I pulled up the police report, they had lied about the count of the pills. Now, this was the first of police reports, which I now have several of, in which the lies are in evidence.
Well, Janet, let's take a break right there. We'll continue this because we do want to find out more about what the police did in this circumstance. And again, as you mentioned, bring this home, as it were, and talk about how your mother's case and how this situation in which her care was placed in the hands of people who appeared not to have her best interests at heart, to put it mildly, how that relates to people listening. And we will continue this discussion with investigative reporter Janet Phelan tomorrow on PID Radio.
Well, that is just part one with our interview, of the interview with Janet Phelan. You have parts two and three coming tomorrow and on Thursday. And we have a contest.
Mm-hmm.
That we're going to tell you about in just a minute, but there are so many things that we're involved in. We are going to add a special show that you can also listen to tonight. And Derek knows more about it than I do.
Yeah, I got an email this afternoon from Visigoth. We've talked with him a couple of times in the past, and we've mentioned him from time to time. He does an excellent program, very thoughtful, called From the Grassy Knoll. In fact, he's been doing his program a lot longer than we've been doing ours. In fact, he was kind of inspirational in kind of guiding where we were going with our program. Mm-hmm. He's got to take a break from doing his program for a couple of weeks. He's got some personal things that need to be attended to, but he's aware of a situation, or became aware of a situation, some people in the Atlanta area who needed some help, need to get a story out there in some ways similar to what Janet Phelan mm-hmm. described in her program tonight. And because of where he's at right now, Viz needed some help getting the program up, so we've got it recorded. We're going to upload it tonight. You can hear it on our server. It's also going to be included in the podcast feed, the RSS feed for the podcast. So if you noticed, if you take mm-hmm. the program with the podcast feed, with iTunes or another podcatching software, you will see an extra program up there tonight. It'll be titled From a Grassy Knoll, mm-hmm. and that's why it's there. It's Visigoth interviewing a lady in the Atlanta area who has run into some trouble with the government, in which in some ways is similar to Janet Phelan's situation, and also in some ways similar to the situation that Susan Lindauer is
mm-hmm,
in.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, since we're mentioning Susan Lindauer, we want to say kudos to everybody listening, and especially to our listener who went beyond, mm-hmm. Just listening and became active. And we heard from Jay Fields.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, he's posted it to his site.
Right. In fact, that's how I found out about it. I went to check in on his site today because it had been reported that today was going to be the next date for Susan in court for her hearing to determine whether she was competent to stand trial.
Mm-hmm.
Turned out that was inaccurate information. But in reading through Jay's updates on her case, found that somebody who heard his interview on PID
Radio
went to his blog, downloaded the medical records, the copies of the medical records, the scans that Jay had posted, printed them out, and sent them to the judge presiding over her case. The judge called her and everybody connected, the attorneys in the case, into his court early one morning and said, I hadn't seen this before. I want to read everything connected to Ms. Lindauer's case.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears, and I don't know if this was part of his decision, but it appears that she will not be sent back to the Carswell facility in Texas. It looks as though she has a good chance of being released to a medical facility, a private facility near her home in Washington, D.C., which is excellent news because Carswell is a facility for people who are violently disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's some really good news. And
so,
whoever you are who took the initiative to send that information to the judge, thank you.
Yay, praise God. Well, tinfoil hat contest.
Yes, very quickly because we are running out of time.
Yeah, we are. We have three, count them, three categories.
Yes.
We have the funniest.
The most original.
And the most high tech.
Yes.
And if that high tech actually takes you back in time, well, that's just extra points.
That's right. We'll be announcing the prizes over the next day or so, and we will have a winner and a runner-up in each category.
That's right. Well, get started on your designs, and if you have any questions or comments, send it to radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
If you'd like to weigh into the forum and express your opinion on the things we discuss here on the show or anything else that catches your attention, the forum is at peeringintodarkness.com/forum.
Well, I just thought of one last thing that I wanted to say. Just
okay.
A second ago, I just about signed off. Before Janet's section came up, we talked about how you did the interview alone, and it just occurred to me that the very first part of the interview, we were both on there.
Right, and it's because your phone died.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So for those of you who are sitting there and thinking, that's odd, because I can't remember how far into the interview that it was just the two, both of us, and at what point you came in. So if you're thinking, how odd, then just understand that I don't get enough sugar in my diet.
Yes. We're trying to wean ourselves from it
because it's going to be taxed.
That's right.
And I no doubt haven't had nearly enough sugar today.
That's right.
All this protein I'm eating. So pray for me and send us that notes. Anyway, until tomorrow with part two with Janet Phelan and news about the contest, I'm Sharon Gilbert.
I'm Derek Gilbert. Thanks for listening to PID Radio.
Bye-bye, everybody. Gonna step up to the microphone. Say loud and clear, a better day.